वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय So we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 9, Chapter 17. Dynasties of Pururava, the dynasties of the sons of Pururava. Yeah. So, Sukadeva Goswami said, from Pururava came a son named Ayu. His very powerful sons were Nahusha, Shatrabuddha, Raji, Rabba, and Anina. Maharaj Prikit. Now hear about the dynasty of Shatrabuddha. Shatrabuddha's son was Suhotra, who had three sons named Kasya, Kusha, and Gujjamada. From Gujjamada came Shunaka, and from him came Shaunaka, the great saint, the best of those conversant with the Rig Veda. So, we've been studying these personalities, those coming in the line of Vivishvan, the sun god, and those coming in the line of the moon god. We've heard about different sons of Ikshvaku. And Ikshvaku had three sons, Vikukshi, Nimi, and Dandaka. And another son of Vaivasvata Manu was Ila. And Ila married Sujumda. Ila was actually a girl. Sujumda was one of the sons of Vaivasvata Manu, but he took a male form and a female form, right? And he married Buddha, who was the son of Chandra. And from Subjumna and Buddha, we got Pururava. So, Pururava is connected through the sun god through Ila and connected through the moon god through Buddha. So, connected to both. And now, here we're looking at the, therefore we're looking at the dynasty coming down from Pururava, and as we said that Pururava connected to the moon dynasty through Buddha, the sun, and connected through the sun god through Sujumna, who had a male and a female form. So this this Pururava. Pururava as we've heard, he's got six sons. And we have heard about one of the sons of Pururava and Uvasi that led us all the way down to the story about Jamadagni and Parasuram and also Vishvamrita Muni. So we've heard about that son. Now we're going to hear about Ayu, another son coming from Pururava and Uvasi. Now this is a very interesting line here, because basically this line coming from Ayu, we'll see that will come down to Yayati, and gradually will come down to the Yadu dynasty, and will come down to Puru, who from where we get the Kuru dynasty. So this is a very important line coming down. First of all, we've heard about the five sons of Pururava had a son Ayu, and there's five sons coming from him. And one of those sons we've heard, we're starting to hear about that Shatrubuddha. And that comes down to the very famous personality, Shonaka Rishi, who we do hear about in this Srimad Bhagavatam. Then, the son of Kasya, so this is another of his sons, was Kasi, and his son was Rashtra, the father of Digatama, and Digatama had a son named Dhanvantari, who was the inaugurator of the medicinal science and an incarnation of Lord Vasudeva. The enjoy of the results of sacrifice. One who remembers the name of Dhanvantari can be released from all disease. So, and so this is another appearance of Dhanvantari. We know that he also appeared from the churning of the milk, and here is another appearance of the same person. The son of Dhanvantari was Ketaman, and his son was Bhimarath. The son of Bhimarath was Devadasa, and the son of Devadasa was Juman, also known as Pratarana. Juman was also known as Satyajit, Vatsa, Ritavaj, and Kavalashva. From him were born Alaka and other sons. Alaka, the son of Juman, reigned over the earth for 66,000 years, my dear King Parikit. No one other than him has reigned over the earth for so long as a young man. From Alaka came a son named Santati, and his son was Sunita. The son of Sunita was Niketana, and the son of Niketana was Dharmaketu, and the son of Dharmaketu was Satyaketu. O King Parikit, from Satyaketu came a son named Drishtaketu, and from Drishtaketu came Sukumara, the emperor of the entire world. From Sukumara came a son named Vitihotra, from Vitihotra, Bhaga, and from Bhaga, Bhagabhumi. Maharaj Parikit, all of these kings were descendants of Kasi, and they could also be called descendants of Shatrubuddha. Right, so that's going back to the great-grandfather of Kasi, And they could also be called, yeah. So the son of Rabba was Rabasa. From Rabasa came Gambira. And from Gambira came a son named Akriya. The son of Akriya was known as Brahmavit. Okay, now hear about the descendants of Anina. From Anina came a son named Shuddha, and his son was Suchi. The son of Suchi was Dharmasarathi, also called Chitrakrit. From Chitrakrit was born a son named Santaraj, a self-realized soul who performed all kinds of Vedic ritualistic ceremonies and therefore did not beget any progeny. The sons of Raji were 500, all very powerful. On the request of the demigods, Raji killed the demons and thus returned the heaven of the kingdom of heaven to Lord Indra. But Indra, fearing such demons as Prahlad, returned the kingdom of heaven to Raji and surrendered himself at Raji's lotus feet. Upon Raji's death, Indra begged Raji's son for the return of the heavenly planet. They did not return it, however, although they agreed to return Indra's shares in ritualistic ceremonies. Purport. Raji conquered the king of heaven, and therefore when Indra, the heavenly king, begged Raji's sons to return it, they refused. Because they had not taken the heavenly king from Indra, the heavenly kingdom from Indra, but had inherited it from their father, they considered it their paternal property. Why then should they return it to the demigods? Thereafter, Brihaspati, the spiritual master of the demigods, offered oblations in the fire so that the sons of Raji would fall from moral principles. When they fell, Lord Indra killed them easily because of their degradation. Not a single one of them remained alive. Yeah, the moral of the story is they should have gave the kingdom of heaven back. From Kusha, the grandson of Kshatrabuddha, was born a son named Prati. The son of Prati was Sanjaya, and the son of Sanjaya was Jaya. From Jaya, Krita was born, and from Krita, King Hayabala. From Haribala came a son named Sahadev, and from Sahadev came Hina. The son of Hina was Jayasena. The son of Jayasena was Sankriti. The son of Sankriti was a powerful and expert fighter named Jaya. These kings were all the members of the Chatrabhuta dynasty. Now let me describe to you the dynasty of Nahusha. All right, so we have heard. Right, so we're looking at the dynasties of the sons of Pururava, and his consort was Urvasi. A very interesting thing which we didn't mention last time, but was that Urvasi, when Naranarayana Rishi was performing austerities, and Indra tried to attract him with some of the heavenly damsels, and then Naranarayana Rishi manifests from his own potencies all these, you know, beautiful girls, you know, heavenly girls, which were more beautiful than anything Indra had ever seen in heaven. And Indra was allowed to take one of them back to heaven, who was at Urvasi. She was manifested from Naranarayana Rishi. So, very significant personality. And of course, she was the one that became the wife of, or the partner of Pururava, who we're hearing about. And so he had one son. He had different sons, and we're hearing about all those coming in the dynasty of Ayu. And as we said, Pururava and Uvasi. There were six sons. So we heard about Vijaya previously, coming down to Parashuram and Chamadagni. And now we're hearing about Ayu. Very, very important. And So far, we've heard about these personalities. We're now going to hear about... So I had the five sons. We've heard all of that which we just heard was one of the sons of Ayu, was Chatrabhuta. So it's called the Chatrabhuta dynasty. Another son of Ayu was Nahusha. And we're going to hear about his dynasty now. Sukadeva Goswami said, O King Parikit, as the embodied soul has six senses, King Nahusha had six sons named Yati, Yayati, Samyati, Ayati, Viyati, and Kriti. When one enters the post of king or head of the government, one cannot understand the meaning of self-realization. Knowing this, Yati, the eldest son of Nahusha, did not accept the power to rule, although it was offered by his father. So politics and ruling a kingdom are very bewildering activities if one is not well trained. As it says in the purport here, that Kshatriyas are generally endowed with material qualities conducive to gaining material wealth and enjoying sense gratification. But those who are spiritually advanced are not interested in material opulence. Indeed, they accept only the bare necessities for a life of spiritual advancement and self-realization. So, especially in modern days, because rulers enter into a very materialistic way of life. But as Prabhupada says, nonetheless, one can attain the highest perfection if one hears Srimad Bhagavatam. Just like Parikit Maharaj. So, because Nahusha, the father of Yayati, molested Indra's wife, Sachi, who then complained to Agastya and other brahmanas, these saintly brahmanas cursed Nahusha to fall from the heavenly planets and be degraded to the status of a python. Consequently, Yayati became the king. King Yayati, and of course, you know, these chapters here of the ninth canto, we do see a few occasions where different personalities who have, they're either great personalities who have opportunity for greatness become distracted by significant sense gratification. And know, from that we can remind ourselves of the verses of the Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita, which explain to us that even if one is a great personality, unless one is engaged in devotional service, the nature of the mind and the senses are practically impossible to control, even by great personality. So we see this, that comes up. So, you know, this process of devotional service is the only path by which one can fully come to that purified state, burning up the desires within the heart for sense gratification. So, because that's quite a big thing there, that, you know, Nahusa, the father of Yayati, molested Indra's wife, Sachi. That's a big thing, you know, to do that to the there's obviously so many opportunities to have enjoy sense gratification with other women, but to become so bewildered, you know, to perform such an activity. And there he was cursed to become a python. So King Yayati had four younger brothers whom he allowed to rule the four directions. Yayati himself married Devayani, the daughter of Sukracharya, and Shamishta, the daughter of Vrishabhava, and ruled the entire earth. Maharaj Prigat said, Sukracharya was a very powerful Brahmana and Maharaj Yayati was a Kshatriya. Therefore, I am curious to know how there occurred this Pratiloma marriage between a Kshatriya and a Brahmana. Sukadeva Goswami said, one day, Vrishabhava's daughter, Shamishta, who was innocent but angry by nature, was walking with Devayani, the daughter of Sukracharya, and with thousands of friends in the palace garden. The garden was full of lotuses and trees of flowers and fruit, and was inhabited by sweetly singing birds and bumblebees. When the young lotus-eyed girls came to the bank of a reservoir of water, they wanted to enjoy by bathing. Thus they left their clothing on the bank and performed sporting, throwing water on one another. While sporting in the water, the girls suddenly saw Lord Shiva passing by, seated on the back of his bull with his wife Parvati. Ashamed because they were naked, the girls quickly got out of the water and covered themselves with their garments. Shamishta unknowingly put Devayani's dress on her own body, thus angering Devayani, who then spoke as follows. Oh, just see the activities of this servant maid, Shamishta. Disregarding all etiquette, she has put on my dress just like a dog, snatching clarified butter meant for use in a sacrifice. We are among the qualified Brahmanas who are accepted as the face of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Brahmanas have created the entire universe by their austerity, and they always keep the absolute truth within the core of their heart. They have directed the path of good fortune, the path of Vedic civilization, and because they are the only worshipful objects within this world, they are offered prayers and worship even by the great demigods, the directors of the various planets, and even by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Super Soul, the Supreme Purifier, the husband of the Goddess of Fortune. And we are even more respectable because we are in the dynasty of Bhrigu. Yet, although this woman's father, being among the demons, is our disciple, she has put on my dress exactly like a sudra taking charge of Vedic knowledge. Dearie, dearie me. Sukadeva Goswami said, when thus rebuked in cruel words, Shamishta was very angry, breathing heavily like a serpent and biting her lower lip with her teeth, She spoke to the daughter of Sukracharya as follows. You beggar. Since an Australian might have a slightly different pronunciation of that. You beggar. Since you don't understand your position, why should you unnecessarily talk so much? Don't all of you wait at our house depending on us for your livelihood like crows? So Prabhupada's purport here is that it is the nature of women to fight verbally at even a slight provocation. As we see from this incident, this has been their nature for a long time. Any comments from the ladies? No? All in agreement? Exactly. Oh. Using such unkind words, Samishta rebuked Devayani, the daughter of Sukracharya, in anger. She took away Devayani's garments and threw Devayani into a well. After throwing Devayani into a well, Samishta went home. Meanwhile, King Yayati, while engaged in a hunting excursion, went to the well to drink water and by chance saw Devayani. Seeing Devayani naked in the well, so Devayani, she's the daughter of Sukracharya, King Yayati immediately gave her his upper cloth. Being very kind to her, he caught her hand with his own and lifted her out. With words saturated with love and affection, Devayani said to King Yayati, a great hero, O king, conqueror of the cities of your enemies, by accepting my hand, you have accepted me as your married wife. And that's how easy it happens. Let me not be touched by others, for our relationship as husband and wife has been made possible by providence, not by any human being. So you'd be surprised what you find in a well. Purport, while taking Devayani out of the well, King Yayati must certainly have appreciated her youthful beauty, and therefore he might have asked her which caste she belonged to. Thus Devayani would have replied immediately, we are already married because you have accepted my hand. Untying the hands of the bride and the bridegroom is a system, uniting the hands of the bride and the bridegroom is a system perpetually existing in all societies. And as you know, the colloquial term around the world for that is tying the knot. So uniting the hands or tying the knot, so can be done in different ways. Sometimes they put a garland around their joined hands, and of course they tie scarves together to make that knot, and then their wedding rings, so many different things. Of course the uniting of the hands and tying of the knot, the actual knot is being tied within the heart of the couples. But there is a most people, when they refer to getting married and they might say, we're tying the knot, they speak of it in terms of a bit sarcastically. It's almost like, or they say, we're getting hitched, which is another version of it, getting hitched. So it's sort of, it's almost like I'm trapped. tying a knot. It's almost like I'm bound and held captive. People speak of it in those terms, but actually properly speaking, it's a bond of their mutual devotion within the heart. That's its proper understanding. Mm. It's like that. And it also it's done with the blessings of the Supreme Lord as well. So, therefore, as soon as Yayati accepted Devayani's hand, they could be regarded as married. Because Devayani was enamored with the hero Yayati, she requested him not to change his mind and let another come to marry her. Translation. Because of falling in the well, I met you. Indeed, this has been arranged by Providence. After I cursed Kaccha, the son of the learned scholar Brihaspati, he cursed me, saying that I would not have a brahmana for a husband. Therefore, O mighty armed one, there is no possibility of my becoming the wife of a brahmana. So this is the providence, how she ended up in this situation, marrying a kshatriya. Although she is the daughter of a brahmana, you would expect that she'd end up with a brahmana husband. Purport. Kaccha, the son of the learned celestial priest, Brihaspati, had been a student of Sukracharya, from whom he had learned the art of reviving a man who has died untimely. This art is called Mritya Sanjivani. Was especially used during wartime. When there was a war, soldiers would certainly die untimely, but if a soldier's body was intact, he could be brought to life again by this art of Mritya Sanjivani. This art was known to Sukracharya and many others, and Kaccha, the son of Brihaspati, became Sukracharya's student to learn it. Devayani desired to have Kaccha as her husband, but Kaccha, out of regard for Sukracharya, looked upon the guru's daughter as a respectable superior and therefore refused to marry her. Devayani angrily cursed Kaccha by saying that although he had learned the art of Mritya Sanjivani from her father, it would be useless. When cursed in this way, Kaccha retaliated by cursing Devayani never to have a husband who is a brahmana. Because Devayani liked Yayati, who was a kshatriya, she requested him to accept her as his bona fide wife. Although this would be Patiloma Vivaha, a marriage between the daughter of a high family and the son of a lower family, she explained that this arrangement was made by Providence. And, So we were discussing before that, Was it Arjun? Didn't Arjun get cursed by, was it Urvasi?
Yeah, yes.
Because she was attracted to him and he considered her, she's actually the wife of Pururava, so, and the dynasty, Yadu dynasty is coming in that line, so she cursed him. What was the curse? It was something. He'd become a eunuch. So during the time of exile, he became Brianella. Sukadeva Goswami continued, because such a marriage is not sanctioned by regular scriptures, King Yayati did not like it, but because it was arranged by Providence and because he was attracted by Devayani's beauty, he accepted her request. So, and then there's, Prabhupada explains, this system, even 50 years ago, this system was current in Hindu society where they look at the astrological chart of the couple, they see if there's some compatibility. And but Prabhupada explains that because of that system they were nicely matched and they'd stayed married generally. It says marriage now takes place simply by agreement. You know, there's not the proper matching. And so it quite often ends in divorce.
Simply raksasa gana means really like...
What's up?
The ganas, the three categories is mentioned in the Bhagavad.
Yes, there's three categories. You've got Deva, Manusha and Rakshasa.
Some people say the raksasa gana in the Iran
chapter. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so sometimes you say to someone, yes, we've got a nice little rakshasa bride for you. Yeah, there are auspicious dates for marriage, but those who are out of Vedic society, it's acceptable for them to marry on the stars which are considered inauspicious.
Mm.
And that's good for them because they have a different nature. Thereafter, when the learned king returned to his palace, Devayani returned home crying and told her father, Sukracharya, all about all that had happened because of Samishta. She told how she had been thrown into the world but was saved by the king. As Sukracharya listened to what had happened to Devayani, his mind was very much aggrieved. Condemning the profession of priesthood and praising the profession of Unchabritti, collecting grains from the fields, he left home with his daughter. Collecting grains from the fields rather than collecting from persons, not depending on anyone, it's a higher form of begging. But,
why did he condemn the profession of priesthood?
It describes here that Sukracharya was certainly very sorry that because of his daughter's complaint, he had to go to his disciple to beg some mercy, which he was obliged to do because he had accepted the profession of priesthood. In his heart, Sukracharya did not like his profession, but since he had accepted it, he was obliged to go unwillingly to his disciple to settle the grievance submitted by his daughter. I guess if he was a Kshatriya, he would have just killed someone.
Is it the kacha or the issue with the kacha? That's what is the disciple
mentioned. What's that?
The disciple mentioned.
Yeah.
Is that kacha?
What is the son? It is the father of Samishta.
Oh, Samishta.
Yeah, the father of Samishta. His name was. Where was that? Does it mention his name there somewhere?
Vrishabhava,
yeah. Mm-hmm. So you've got Sukracharya, and then Vrishabhava is more in a servant role to Sukracharya. And because he's a servant, as a servant, he's also addressed like a disciple. And so his daughter, is the daughter of a servant of Sukracharya. So... and now Sukracharya... is having to resolve this as a priest would by begging to resolve the situation. So King Vrishabhava understood that Sukracharya was coming to chastise or curse him. Consequently, before Sukracharya came to his house, Vrishabhava went out and fell down in the street at the feet of his guru and satisfied him, checking his wrath. The powerful Sukracharya was angry for a few moments, but upon being satisfied, he said to Vrishabhava, "My dear king, kindly fulfill the desire of Devayani, for she is my daughter, and in this world I cannot give her up or neglect her." Purport. So, purport. Sometimes a great personality like Sukracharya cannot neglect sons and daughters. For sons and daughters are by nature dependent on their father, and the father has affection for them. Although Sukracharya knew that the quarrel between Devayani and Samishta was childish, as Devayani's father, he had to side with his daughter. He did not like to do this, but he was obliged to because of affection. He plainly admitted that although he should not have asked the king for mercy for his daughter, because of affection, he could not avoid doing so. So, you know, Vrishabhava, he's a servant of a brahmana, but at the same time, he's, you know, has a royal position. And so he's obviously, you know, taking significant counsel from Sukracharya as well. But basically, you know, he's still in the position of a servant of Sukracharya. You know, one has to approach a brahmana very submissively in a humble way, even if one is a king. Now, Samishta has thrown, you know, Devayani, who's the daughter of the guru, into the well. So that's a problem. So of course, Sukracharya needs to take his daughter's side, which is natural. And he wants Vrishabhava, you know, not to be, you know, for them to not to sort of, you know, end up in some battle with each other. So Vrishabhava is a bit fearful of Sukracharya, that he could curse him quite easily. And Vrishabhava as a king, you know, although in one sense Sukracharya really would have no fear of him, but he doesn't like the whole situation. He wants the whole situation resolved in an amicable way rather than he has to curse him, and, you know, there may be, you know, attempts at violence by Vrishabhava, you know, so it's a tricky situation. So after hearing Sukracharya's request, Vrishabhava agreed to fulfill Devayani's desire and he awaited her words. Devayani then expressed her desire as follows: "Whenever I marry by the order of my father, my friend Samishta must go with me as my maidservant along with her friends." Vrishabhava wisely thought that Sukracharya's displeasure would bring danger and that his pleasure would bring material gain. Therefore, he carried out Sukracharya's order and served him like a slave. He gave his daughter Sumistha to Devayani, and Sumistha served Devayani like a slave, along with thousands of other women. So really, you know, Devayani's become proud. Sumistha's really, you know, to throw someone naked into a well and leave him for dead is childish, but, you know, it could have been, had, you know, very much more serious ramifications if she had died of broken limbs or what have you. But, so Sumistha's done something, and that's the daughter of the guru. So that's quite a big problem. At the same time, it really, it came about, you know, with Devayani sort of insulting her. So it's a very unfortunate situation, and that never should have happened. And then you've got Sukracharya having to rather than admonish his daughter, you know, he's asking, you know, the king to just allow him to take his daughter's side, you know, and here are the ramifications of that the king's saying, well, okay, if I take your daughter's side, and then look what she's asked for. Something quite, I mean, that'd be devastating for both the king and for the daughter, in one sense. So, but this, you know, very, very common situation, and I see this amongst devotees as well, that, you know, over the course of many years, quite often adults, you know, good devotees, have very significant fallouts because of the childish behaviour of the kids. I've seen that many times. It's very entangling and very difficult to deal with. And sometimes what happens is that, in one sense, Sukracharya really hasn't done anything. But in another sense, he probably shouldn't have agreed, you know, really, if there was a proper friendship between these two, he probably wouldn't have allowed his Devayani to ask such a huge sacrifice from Sumistha. Mm-hmm. You know, that's quite... And of course, that's sometimes what happens. So when Sukracharya gave Devayani in marriage to Yayati, he had Sumistha go with her, but he warned the king, "My dear king, never allow this girl Sumistha to lie with you in your bed." Right, so that would be just too much for Sukracharya and Devayani. Oh, King Parikh, upon seeing Devayani, so, you know, there's a real treacherous situation there. O King Parikit, upon seeing Devayani with a nice son, Sumistha once approached King Yayati at the appropriate time for conception. In a secluded place, she requested the king, the husband of her friend, Devayani, to enable her to have a son also. When Princess Sumistha begged King Yayati for a son, the king was certainly aware of the principles of religion, and therefore he agreed to fulfill her desire. Although he remembered the warning of Sukracharya, he thought of this union as a desire of the Supreme, and thus he had sex with Sumistha. So, you know, you see that verse in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2, verse 7, where Arjun surrenders unto Krishna because and Prabhupada explains, this is the nature of this world. You know, it is so perplexing. Mm-hmm. That everyone will just get into a situation where you can't go forward, you can't go back, you can't say yes, you can't say no, you can't agree, you can't disagree, you can't do your duty, you can't not do your duty. And that's the nature of this world. And the only way to resolve it is to come to the spiritual platform above the bodily platform. And of course, a lot of these problems, as we see, as with Arjuna, is that Sukracharya is making decisions on the bodily platform related to his daughter. Devayani was making decisions on basis that she was a brahmana and the other person was lesser. The whole thing has arisen due to the bodily platform of life, the perplexities. It is rising above that bodily platform of life by which doing things for the pleasure of the Supreme Lord is the only way that one can rise above this. And this is, you know, the very nature of this world. Even on such an exalted platform of these personalities. So, purport, King Yayati was completely aware of the duty of a Kshatriya. When a Kshatriya is approached by a woman, he cannot deny her. This is a religious principle. Consequently, when Dharmaraj Yudhisthira saw Arjuna unhappy after Arjuna returned from Dwarka, he asked whether Arjuna had refused a woman who had begged for a son. Although Maharaj Yayati remembered Sukracharya's warning, he could not refuse Sumishta. He thought it wise to give her a son, and thus he had sexual intercourse with her father, with her after her menstrual period. This kind of lust is not against religious principles. As stated in Bhagavad Gita 7.11, sex life, not contrary to the principles of religion, is sanctioned by Krishna. Thus, Samista, the daughter of a king, had begged Yayati for a son. The combination was not lust, but an act of religion. And again, this is, you know, we see that Arjuna, on the strength of religious principles, he tried to solve his perplexity by, bringing forth so many different religious principles. But the problem is that many of the religious principles were also based upon activities relating to the modes of material nature. So they didn't resolve it either. And therefore, once again, you see the same principle. Therefore, one has to rise above not only the bodily platform of life, but the religious principles that are based upon the bodily platform of life in order to, and therefore one has to come to the spiritual platform. So it's the same scenario playing out for every living entity in the material world. Devayani gave birth to Yadu and to Vasu, and Sumishta gave birth to Druhu, Anu and Puru.
Three children in one conception.
I don't know if they're all born at once, but they so
they were born several times.
Yeah, so we've got Devayani gave birth to the Yadu. So that's coming from the... she's the daughter of a brahmana with a kshatriya husband. And Yadu and Tavasu, yeah. So that's two. And then Sumishta, who's the daughter of a kshatriya, married to a kshatriya, gave birth to Druhu, Anu and Puru. Right? So within the Yadu dynasty, there's a little bit of brahmana and kshatriya. And within the Puru dynasty, there's kshatriya and kshatriya. When the proud Devayani understood from outside sources that Sumishta was pregnant by her husband, she was frenzied with anger. Now, who would have expected that? Thus she departed for her father's house. King Yayati, who was very lusty, followed his wife, caught her, and tried to appease her by speaking pleasing words and massaging her feet, but he could not satisfy her by any means. I didn't think so. Sukracharya was extremely angry. You untruthful fool! Lusting after women. You have done a great wrong, he said. I therefore curse you to be attacked and disfigured by old age and invalidity. King Yayati said, O learned, worshipful Brahmana, I have not yet satisfied my lusty desires with your daughter. Sukracharya then replied, You may exchange your old age with someone who will agree to transfer his youth to you. So, as mentioned, the purport, the Sukracharya has seen that it's actually against the interest of his own daughter, you know, for Yati to continue in old age. So he made an adjustment. When Yati received this benediction from Sukracharya, he requested his eldest son, my dear Yadu, please give me your youth in exchange for my old age and invalidity. My dear son, I am not yet satisfied in my sexual desires, but if you are kind to me, you can take the old age given by your maternal grandfather, and I may take your youth so that I may enjoy life for a few years more. Purport. This is the nature of lusty desires. In Bhagavad Gita 7.20, it is said, Kamesh taste hiti gyana. When one is too attached to sense gratification, he actually loses his sense. So, you know, and of course that's an interesting verse to quote, because we see that, you know, that verse is quoted. And it shows you that it is because of lusty desires that so many materially motivated forms of worship of God or gods has appeared. So Prabhupada mentioning that here is an example. The father shamelessly asked his son to exchange youth for old age. Of course, the entire world is under such illusion. Therefore, it is said that everyone is pramatta or exclusively mad. When one becomes almost like a madman, he indulges in sex and sense gratification. Sense gratification can be controlled, however, and one achieves perfection when he has no desires for sex. This is possible only when one is fully Krishna conscious. So this verse quoted by Jamunacharya, that since I've been engaged in the transcendental loving service of Krishna, realizing ever new pleasure in him, whenever I think of sex pleasure, I spit at the thought and my lips curl with distaste. Sexual desire can be stopped only when one is fully Krishna conscious and not otherwise. As long as one has desires for sex, one must change his body and transmigrate from one body to another to enjoy sex in different species or forms. But although the forms may differ, the business of sex is the same. Therefore it is said, Puna punas chavita chavananam. Those who are very much attached to sex transmigrate from one body to another for the same business of chewing the chewed, tasting sex enjoyment as a dog, sex enjoyment as a hog, sex enjoyment as a demigod, and so on. And do we get a Bhagavad Gita here? So And we see, you know, thank you. You know, this we see this coming up in this section of the Bhagavatam, many different stories, 8th and 9th canto, about very big personalities, learned, austere, exalted personalities, still, due to a lack of Krishna consciousness, not being able to fully conquer over sex life. And therefore, there's this very appropriate verse quoted in the Bhagavad Gita. You know, in this same section, the 5th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada also quotes that verse by Jamunacharya, Yad Avadi Mama, that, you know, his lips curl with distaste when he thinks of sex life. And in verse 26 of that 5th chapter, there's this verse from the Srimad Bhagavatam 4:22:39. Oh, no, it's the same one. Yeah, that just try to worship in devotional service Vasudev, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Even great sages are not able to control the forces of the senses as effectively as those who are engaged in transcendental bliss by serving the lotus feet of the Lord, uprooting the deep-grown desire for fruitive activities.
425.
That's from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 5, verse 26, and Srila Prabhupada cites that verse from the Srimad Bhagavatam, canto 4, chapter 22, text number 39. And to me, that verse really epitomizes the message that we should receive through this section. When, you know, again and again we see, and, you know, I like that term here that Prabhupada says, or the Bhagavatam says, that even great sages are not able to control the forces of the senses as effectively as those engaged in transcendental bliss. So they're, you know, these personalities, sometimes they can control their senses for thousands of years in meditation and what have you. And then, you know, within the course of their lifetime, they may have one or two, you know, big fall downs where they just, you know, cannot, you know, control their, you know, sex life. But it really, it defines their position. I was actually looking at, you know, a few of the examples. Of course, we have, there's Vishvamrita and Menaka, right? And that's mentioned in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2, verse 60. That he heard the tinkling of the bangles, and his, you know, broke his meditation. And she was actually sent to delude him. Menaka, one of the, you know, society girls, one of the beautiful apsaras from the heavenly planets, actually. Yeah. And he then united with Menaka and had a child called Sukuntala. And we'll hear a little bit more about that later. And then, of course, you've got, again, we're talking about Urvasi, who we were discussing. She appeared from Naranarayana Rishi.
Mm.
And so above all the heavenly damsels, she surpasses all of them. But when Mitra and Varuna saw Urvasi, they also tried to control their lust, but they could not, and they discharged semen, which Vasistha kept in a pot. And then from that was born Agastya. Agastya and someone else, there was two that were born from that. Agastya and... I'll come to it, but there was two people born from that. One of them was Agastya. So that was Mitra and Varuna, they saw Urvasi. And then we see that, you know, we've heard about Buddha who kidnapped Brihaspati's wife. Tara, and that's how Pururava was born. And of course, Pururava then, he also became enchanted by Urvasi, and that's beginning this dynasty. And and then there was Saradvan, that's mentioned. We're going to come to this in this ninth, in these chapters. He saw Urvasi. He discharged semen, which fell on a clump of grass, and from that, Creeper and Creepy were born.
What is his name?
Saradvan. Saradvan. That's mentioned in ninth canto, chapter 1, verses 35 to 36. We're going to come to that. And we're also going to come to where Brihaspati, this is in Canto 9, chapter 20, verse 36, where Brihaspati was attracted by his brother's wife, Mamata. Mamata, even while she was pregnant. And, you know, so there are many examples, you know, of very very great personalities, but not on the platform of you know, full engagement in devotional service. So we're going to come across some of those, but it is very much a theme of this ninth canto, which refers to liberation.
And
what's up? Yes, Sabari Muni, yeah. That's right, yes, that's right, from the fish.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, there's quite a few examples, and that verse from the, we cited from the fourth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, cited from that verse in the fifth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, that really sums up that unless one fully engages in devotional service, these very, very great personalities, they can't as effectively control their senses. You know, what to speak of people in the Kali Yuga, the ordinary people in the Kali Yuga, is just not going to happen. And that's, you know, the message that we should take from this too. And of course, I was listening to... verse. Very nice airport there, but you know, basically, the whole Bhagavad Gita is geared towards the soul coming to the point where the mind is very blissfully always engaged in thinking of Krishna. And if the mind is always blissfully, as Prabhupada mentions, that, you know, work properly done is actually done with the mind, not the body, the senses. And the whole secret of the teachings of the Gita is that if we have our mind engaged, then automatically, if our minds are engaged in Krishna consciousness, then our senses will automatically be engaged. So that the real trick of spiritual life is to engage the mind in Krishna consciousness. That's the key point to understand from the Bhagavad Gita. Always think of me, Krishna says. Always think of me. Let's see if I can find... There was a purport here. I'm just trying to... Right. So, so you know, in this, in the introduction to the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada sort of sums this up nicely. So Prabhupada mentions that Prabhupada quotes from 647 that of all yogis, the one with great faith who always abides in me, thinks of me within himself and renders transcendental loving service to me, is the most intimately united with me in yoga and is the highest of all. That is my opinion. So one who thinks of the Supreme Lord always is the greatest yogi. Right? So we're seeing all these great yogi persons and Raja Rishis. They're not as great as a person who always, the bhakti yogi, is always thinking of Krishna. So one who thinks of the Supreme Lord always is the greatest yogi, the supermost jnani, and the greatest devotee at the same time. The Lord further tells Arjuna that as a kshatriya he cannot give up his fighting, but if Arjuna fights remembering Krishna, then he will be able to remember Krishna at the time of death. But one must be completely surrendered in the transcendental loving service of the Lord. We work not with our body, actually, but with our mind and intelligence. So if the intelligence and the mind are always engaged in the thought of the Supreme Lord, then naturally the senses are also engaged in the service. See? And this is the fault of all these personalities, is that their minds are not fixed blissfully upon the personality of Godhead, and therefore their senses cannot fully be controlled. Superficially at least, the activities of the senses remain the same, but the consciousness is changed. The Bhagavad Gita teaches one how to absorb the mind and intelligence in the thought of the Lord. Such absorption will enable one to transfer himself to the kingdom of the Lord. If the mind is engaged in Krishna's service, then the senses are automatically engaged in his service. This is the art, and this is also the secret of Bhagavad Gita. Total absorption in the thought of Krishna. So you see that? Prabhupada is saying, this is the secret of the whole Gita, is to, you know, fix the mind on Krishna. Then everything else comes. One becomes the greatest jnani, yogi, and bhakti. Now, I like this. Modern man has struggled very hard to reach the moon, but he has not tried very hard to elevate himself spiritually. If one has 50 years of life ahead of him, he should engage that brief time in cultivating this practice of remembering the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So you imagine these great personalities who have elevated themselves over many lifetimes to such an elevated position as Sukracharya or Brihaspati or what have you, how much endeavour over many lifetimes? So, you know, which, you know, equates to going to the higher planets or going to the moon. But what they haven't done is spent some of that time trying to fix their mind on the personality of Godhead. All that time getting to those positions, if they spent a fraction of that just trying to fix their mind on the personality of Godhead, they would have been a lot better off. It's quite a nice point by Prabhupada. He says this practice is the devotional practice. He mentions Shravanam, Kirtan and Vishnu. These nine processes, of which the easiest is Shravanam, hearing the Bhagavad Gita from the realized person will turn one to the thought of the Supreme Being. This will lead to remembering the Supreme Lord and will enable one, upon leaving the body, to attain a spiritual body which is just fit for association with the Supreme Lord. So, you know, in this, he goes over that point again and again. And actually, in that introduction, he also explains, or, you know, the very beginning of the Gita, that these literatures, Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, they're meant for that purpose to, you know, we can have so much, you know, discussion points for the mind to be fixed upon. So, you know, and that's the purpose, you know, these bhakti, courses. What you want is that everyone who comes out of the bhakti courses, they have a greater degree to fix their mind on Krishna. And if that's not happening, then the main thing why we're teaching them, and that's the very message they should come out of it. So if that's not happening, you can get a superficial result, isn't it? So that's what you really want, that, you know, at the end, a bhakti shastri, all the devotees there have a greater ability that within the course of their activities in life, they can always feel the presence of the Lord and always think of Him. If that's not happening, the result is, you know, there's a good result, but it can be a little bit superficial. The main result must be there. We must always keep that in mind. And of course, that's, you know, we're seeing here examples in this ninth chapter where we're talking about liberation. Liberation means that where's the mind? On the bodily concept of life or with Krishna. That's liberation.
So this second chapter...
What I just read then? Yeah, that was the introduction.
Yeah,
starting from where Prabhupada quotes Yoganam Abhisavisham. And he elaborates on that very, very nice. You know. And of course you'd expect that in Prabhupada's introduction, that he just sums up the essence. You know, this is what you want to get out of the Bhagavad Gita, like that ability. So these examples are showing us that trying to stop lusty desires, otherwise, if these great personalities, you know, they certainly have great successes, but they can't really fully do it. They can't come to the properly liberated platform. And so we should understand that. Don't bother going down that path. Not for this lifetime, not for 100 lifetimes. It just doesn't work. So Yadu replied, "My dear father, you have already achieved old age, although you also were a young man. But I do not welcome your old age and invalidity, for unless one enjoys material happiness, one cannot attain renunciation. So again, bearing in mind that in Prabhupada's purport, he reminds us that renunciation of material enjoyment is the ultimate goal of human life. Therefore, the Varnashram institution is most scientific. It aims at giving one the facility to return home back to Godhead, which one cannot do without completely renouncing all connections with the material world. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, one who wants to go back home, back to Godhead, must be niskinchana, free from all affinity for material enjoyment. Unless one is fully renounced, one cannot engage in devotional service or stay in Brahman. Devotional service is rendered on the Brahman platform. That's completely above the bodily platform. And Prabhupada says, in other words, a person engaged in devotional service is already on the Brahman platform. So then it describes that generally, unless one enjoys material happiness, one cannot attain renunciation. Varnashram therefore gives the opportunity for gradual elevation. Yadu, the son of Maharaj Yayati, explained that he was unable to give up his youth, for he wanted to use it to attain the renounced order in the future. And of course, you know, at one stage, I remember in Mayapur, I think it was in 1975, Prabhupada was saying that no more sannyas, you know, because some had fallen down, you know. So, and he, this principle, you know, they're going to have to go through grihastha life, you know, for some time. Otherwise, you know, and then, you know, when they're good and ready, you know, then we'll give sannyas, you know, like that. So it's this principle that, they need to enjoy some material happiness.
Just one comment, yeah. This is enter the seventh canto, where Narada is explaining Varnashram. There is one verse that is mentioned that one has to go through full or an overdose of material enjoyment.
Yes.
To renounce the material enjoyment. And give the example of pouring too much of ghee into the fire, that will put off the fire. Just,
That, therefore, you know, the Varnashram system is scientific. Prabhupada mentions that. Very interesting point of the Gita. Because it's a good question, what you're asking, you know. Too much sense gratification, then the Varnashram in one sense is almost promoting sense gratification. So, mentions here that... it's in those verses of Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada's mentioning that in those verses where the early part of the second chapter, Srila Prabhupada mentions there that actually every duty that one performs in the Varnashram system will elevate one to a higher level. That's the difference. The Varnashram is very scientific, so it's in there, I can't find it, but in those, Krishna's talking about Kshatriya life and killing and what have you, you know, and killing is part of the Kshatriya business. And every aspect, so whether you're performing activities as a sudra, vaishya, you know, the ashrams, the varnas and ashrams, If you actually perform them, you will elevate to a higher level.
Mm.
So you're allowed to engage in sense gratification on that level, but it's so scientifically arranged that you're being promoted only. You're not being degraded. Without the Varnashram science, if one engages in sense gratification, where there's no relationship to the personality of Godhead in one's duties, and also where, you know, the balance is not right between, you know, how much sense gratification is good and how it should be reduced, then one will be degraded. And that's the difference.
So this is when you mentioned more sense gratification, that will give detachment, that is within the Varnashram. Or may I go to the max?
Yeah.
That will bring detachment.
Yeah.
Not unlimited.
That's right. Yeah. So this is, you know, within the realms of the Varnashram, yes, sometimes it's understood that, and that's what I was saying, that Prabhupada, you know, was saying, that no more sannyas, you know, they're going to have to enjoy some sense gratification in married life. I'm not giving sannyas.
Mm.
They obviously haven't fulfilled that.
Mm.
Like that. So under guru, you know, sometimes restricting, sometimes allowing.
Mm.
So when it's done scientifically under the authorities, allowance of sense gratification will promote one, allow one to, you know, advance. But not just unscientifically, you know, not under a guru, you know, and not, you know, connected to the Varnashram principle. So, you know, it's a great science. But as Prabhupada explains, you know, therefore he uses that example of cutting your nails. You know, they need to be cut, but if you cut them too much, it gives too much pain. Yeah, so if you cut sense gratification too much in a person, it will give too much pain. So, you know, it has to be done properly. You can't let them grow too much. You can't cut them too hard. Essentially, he uses that example. And so, sense gratification is like that. Sometimes he mentions it's like salt. A little bit, you know, not too much. You know, it's required in one sense. So, you know, the Varnashram, in some cases it's required, in some cases, you know. So it has to be done scientifically. And therefore, Prabhupada gives that example. You know, people say, oh, sex is required. Yes. So then, you know, in Varnashram it's given. He says, but salt is also required. But you're not going to have a whole bag of salt. You're not going to just have it unlimited. Oh, salt, you know, salt is required. It's allowed. Oh, I'll just give you a whole cup of salt. Go. You know. But we say also, yes, sex is sense gratification allowed. But, you know, you don't kill yourself with it. So, you know, this is an interesting verse here that, yes. Anyway, so Maharaj Yadu, this purport, was different from his brothers, as stated in the next verse. Maharaj Yadu's brothers refused to accept their father's proposal because they were not completely aware of Dharma. To accept the orders that follow religious principles, especially the orders of one's father, is very important. Therefore, when the brothers of Maharaj Yadu refused the father's order, this was certainly irreligious. Maharaj Yadu's refusal, however, was religious. Maharaj Yadu was completely aware of the principles of religion. The ultimate principle of religion is to engage oneself in devotional service to the Lord. Maharaj Yadu was very eager to engage himself in the Lord's service, but there was an impediment. During youth, the material desire to enjoy the material senses is certainly present. And unless one fully satisfies these lusty desires in youth, there is a chance of one's being disturbed in rendering service to the Lord. we have actually seen that many sannyasis who accept sannyas prematurely, not having satisfied their material desires, fall down because they are disturbed. And Prabhupada mentioned that, you know, also in reference to ISKCON, his sannyasis, his disciples. Therefore, the general process is to go through grihastha life and vanaprastha life and finally come to sannyas and devote oneself completely to the service of the Lord. Maharaj Yadu was ready to accept his father's order, his order, and exchange youth for old age, because he was confident that the youth taken by his father would be returned. But because this exchange would delay his complete engagement in devotional service, he did not want to accept his father's old age, for he was eager to achieve freedom from disturbances. Moreover, among the descendants of Yadu would be Lord Krishna. Therefore, because Yadu was eager to see the Lord's appearance in his dynasty as soon as possible, Yadu refused to accept his father's proposal. This was not irreligious, however, because Yadu's purpose was to serve the Lord. Because Yadu was a faithful servant of the Lord, Lord Krishna appeared in his dynasty, as confirmed in the prayers of Kunti. Yadu Priyasya Bhavaye. Yadu was very dear to Krishna, who was therefore eager to descend in Yadu's dynasty. In conclusion, Maharaj Yadu should not be considered a dharmagya, ignorant of religious principles, as the next verse designates his brothers. He was like the four Shanakas who refused the order of their father Brahma for the sake of a better cause. Because the four Kumaras wanted to engage themselves completely in the service of the Lord as brahmacharis, they refused to obey their father's order. Their refusal to obey the father's order was not irreligious. So, Maharaj Yadu, he's not welcoming to follow that order and accept his old age and invalidity. He's claiming that, you know, unless one enjoys mature happiness, one cannot attain renunciation, and he wants to attain the platform of rendering service to the Lord. So, Maharaj Pariki, Yayati similarly requested his sons Tuvasu, Druhu and Anu to exchange the youth for his old age, but because they were unaware of religious principles, they thought that their flickering youth was eternal and therefore they refused to carry out their father's order. King Yayati then requested Puru, who was younger than these three brothers, but more qualified. My dear son, do not be disobedient like your older brothers. But that is not your duty. Puru replied, O your majesty, who in this world can repay his debt to his father? By the mercy of one's father, one gets a human form of life, which can enable one to become an associate of the Supreme Lord. As a son who acts by anticipating what the father wants him to do is first class. One who acts upon receiving his father's orders is second class. And one who executes his father's order irreverently is third class. But a son who refuses his father's order is like a father's stool. Sukadeva Goswami said, in this way, Maharaj Pariksit, the son named Puru was very pleased to accept the old age, and his father Yayati... of his father Yayati, who took the youth of his son and enjoyed this material world as he required. Thereafter, King Yayati became the ruler of the entire world, consisting of seven islands, and ruled the citizens exactly like a father. Because he had taken the youth of his son, his senses were unimpaired, and he enjoyed as much material happiness as he desired. In secluded places, engaging her mind, words, body and various paraphernalia, Devayani, the dear wife of Maharaj Yayati, always brought her husband the greatest possible transcendental bliss. King Yayati performed various sacrifices in which he offered abundant gifts to the Brahmanas to satisfy the Supreme Lord Hari, who is the reservoir of all the demigods and the object of all Vedic knowledge. Yeah, so, he's passed on the curse to his son, and he's apparently having a good time. So, this verse here, describing Lord Hari, who is being worshipped by Maharaj Shayati, that the Supreme Lord Vasudeva, who created the cosmic manifestation, exhibits himself as all-pervading, like the sky that holds clouds. And when the creation is annihilated, everything enters into the Supreme Lord Vishnu, and varieties are no longer manifested. Without material desires, Maharaj Jayati worshipped the Supreme Lord, who is situated in everyone's heart as Narayan and invisible to material eyes, although existing everywhere. The purport: King Jayati, although externally seeming very fond of material enjoyment, was internally thinking of becoming an eternal servant of the Lord. Although Maharaj Jayati was the king of the entire world and he engaged his mind and five senses in enjoying material possessions for 1,000 years, he was unable to be satisfied. Purport: the Kad Indriya or unpurified senses can be purified if one engages the senses and the mind in Krishna consciousness. Sarvapari Vinirmuktam Tatparat Vena Nirmalam. One must be freed from all designations. When one identifies himself with the material world, his senses are impure. But when one achieves spiritual realization and identifies himself as the servant of the Lord, his senses are purified immediately. Engagement of the purified senses in the service of the Lord is called bhakti. Rishikesha Sevanam Bhakti Uchate. One may enjoy the senses for many thousands of years, but unless one purifies the senses, one cannot be happy. So we're going to hear how King Yayati achieved liberation. Sukadeva Goswami said, O Maharaj Parikit, Yayati was very much attached to a woman. In due course of time, however, when disgusted with sexual enjoyment and its bad effects, he renounced this way of life and narrated the following story to his beloved wife. My dearly beloved wife, daughter of Sukracharya, in this world, there was someone exactly like me. Please listen as I narrate the history of his life. By hearing about the life of such a householder, those who have retired from householder life always lament. So, Prabhupada mentions that vanaprasthas who have retired from family life generally lament about their past family life because it engaged them in trying to fulfill lusty desires. Prahlad Maharaj said that one should retire from family life as soon as possible, and he described family life as the dark as well. If one continuously or permanently concentrates on living with his family, he should be understood to be killing himself. So when he becomes expert or accustomed to forest lives, having become vanaprastha, he should accept sannyas. Sannyas means accepting unalloyed engagement in the service of the Lord. One should be very much ashamed of remaining a householder and not promoting oneself to the two higher stages, namely vanaprastha and sannyas. So, and of course, you know, this is we see that you know, in the life of a devotee, the more one is you know, still battling with you know, strong material desires in one's heart, it slows the spiritual advancement down quite considerably. And you know, every devotee, you know, they, you know, we should look and see that you know, if I could control my mind and my senses and just always be absorbed in trying to serve Krishna, you know, but you know, that would be a very speedy progress of advancement. But you know, we must look at ourselves and we see that, but I've had this, you know, impurity in the heart. It's made me make these decisions which have slowed down my progress, and you know, taken up so much time, taken up so much energy, like this. You know, that's how we should look at ourselves. You know, so it's interesting because, you know, when we, you know, as devotees, you know, quite often, you know, we're doing two things. We're trying to attract people to the life of grihastha life, you know, because we want the whole world to stop running around having illicit sex. So we want them to, you know, one wife, one husband, settle down, you know, control your senses and have children in Krishna consciousness. So we want that. So we sort of, so, you know, therefore we like to glorify grihasthas, you know, that, oh yes, you know, Zoe has been married for so many years and they've raised their children, you know, so we like to glorify. But, you know, it's sort of a more public, you know, display. But, you know, personally we should be, you know, we should try to, you know, take up the mood of the Bhagavatam to be a little ashamed, you know. Why am I spending so long, you know, to, you know, make advancement in Krishna consciousness, and I'm sort of dilly-dallying around, you know, with these material desires. That should be, you know, the mood. But we shouldn't, what I have seen in ISKCON is that instead of devotees taking that mood of just quietly, you know, being critical of themselves, at even in public or, you know, in lectures, you know, they have a go at other devotees. You know, they sort of have cynical jokes about, you know, the grihasthas and, you know, things like that. So that's not good. You know, that's not good. We shouldn't do that, you know, because it's against the preaching. You know, but that's how this, you know, I've seen this play out in ISKCON in that way. Or you're shameful, you know, not like we're just quietly, you know, looking at ourselves, you know, how we're delaying our own advancement, but, you know, proudly looking at other devotees and belittling, you know, or, you know, they've had another child, you know, was married twice, you know. Actually, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta, so is what they call, he admonished his father, Srila Bhakti Vinodha Kaur, when he married for a second time. You know, he was, you know, second time. So, you know, this is between liberated souls, of course, you know, it's a whole different platform, but it shows you, you know, that, you know, like, you know, don't you feel something, you know, father, you're marrying twice, you know? But that's a joke between niche sitters. We shouldn't try to imitate that. But yeah, we should be very careful of that. you know, treating, you know, treating the life of grihasthas, you know, that they're shameful. You know, why are you still a grihastha? Why are you having another child? Why are you married again? You know, why are you, you know, 50? You're 60 now. I'm 61. You know, like that. We should be very careful of that because it's very destructive to our movement, actually. And it's actually just a, it's more like envy, you know. But, you know, quietly devotees should have that mood. You know, they should be, we should look at ourselves, you know, that, you know, why am I wasting so much time? You know, one lifetime, you know, if I actually, you know, can get off the bodily platform fully, how much advancement I'd make in just my mind always fixed on Krishna and just go back to God. You know, that's, you know, that's that. That's how we take up this mood here. I remember.
Although the knowledge and the instructions are clear,
they're not clear to me.
The practical application of it seems to have tremendous lag behind it.
The practical application. That's right. The, it's a. It, you know, we have to be very thoughtful. I remember, you know, in Adelaide, just to give, you know, to give you some practical evidences. when I you know, because I had daughters, in ISKCON, if you had a son rather than a daughter, you know, it was almost, that was auspicious. If you had daughter, it was like, you know, you sort of dipped out. That was inauspicious. That was a mood in ISKCON. And so much so that, you know, I remember in Adelaide, we'd have, the men would sit in a circle, you know, here, and the women in another circle, so it was a big room. So they were sort of in the same room, but, you know, they'd be eating prasadam there. And then, so if you had a son, you know, generally perhaps some of the senior devotees, because they promoted themselves, you know, they were promoted as always detached, they could sit with their son, that was okay. Even other grihasthas, you know, they weren't in an advanced position, for them to sit with their sons even was looked down upon, you know, the children with the women over the time. But if you sat with your daughter, as I did, it was unheard of. And literally, they were, you know, I'd be sitting there eating my prasad. I've got my daughter, you know, one on each side of me. And they'd be literally joking amongst them, sniggering, you know. It's Gunga. And they'd be laughing. It was just too much for them. It was like, you know, he should be ashamed of himself. That was a move. So that's why I say this, because I've lived through that. You can imagine how, you know, trying to shield your daughters from that as they're growing up, you know, because it was there. What to speak of your wife, and, you know, it should never have happened. But that's why, you know, one should be very careful, giving classes. And this is why we have these courses. So that, you know, we don't, oh yes, I read in the Bhagavad Gita, you all should be ashamed of yourself. Yeah, you know, you think, you know, like that. We have to be very careful how we preach these things. I thought I'd mention that in that verse. You'd have seen the worst of it. So while wandering in the forest, eating to satisfy his senses, a he-goat, now look how he's, you know, presenting this. A goat, right? So he's comparing himself to a goat. And of course, he also compares his wife to a she-goat. Now, I don't know how that's going to go down. But so he says, while wandering in the forest, eating to satisfy his senses, a he-goat by chance approached a well in which he saw a she-goat standing helplessly, having fallen into it by the influence of the results of fruitive activities. All right, so Yayati is comparing himself to a he-goat and Devyani to a she-goat. and describes the nature of man and woman. Now, of course, women in this movement don't even like to be compared to a veritable cow of plenty, let alone, you know, a goat. So, you know, Prabhupada explains the analogy that, you know, without being cared for a man, cared for by a man, a woman cannot be happy. Indeed, she is just like a she-goat that has fallen into a well and is struggling for existence. Therefore, a woman must take shelter of the father. As, like that. The father gives the daughter to a suitable man. So, so when King Yayati delivered Devayani from the well, she felt great relief and requested Yayati to accept her as his wife. But when Maharaj Yayati accepted Devayani, he became too attached and had sex life not only with her but with others, like Shamishta. Yet still he was dissatisfied. Therefore, one should retire by force from such family life as Yayati's. When one is fully convinced of the degrading nature of worldly family life, one should completely renounce this way of life, take sannyas, and engage himself fully in the service of the Lord, then one's life will be successful. Translation. After planning how to get the she-goat out of the well, the lusty he-goat dug up the earth on the well's edge with the point of his horns in such a way that she was able to come out very easily. Purport. Attraction for women is the impetus for economic development, housing, and many other things meant for living comfortably in this material world. Digging up the earth to make a way out for the she-goat was a laborious task, but before accepting the she-goat, the he-goat underwent this labour. The union between male and female provides the impetus for gaining a nice apartment, good income, children and friends. Thus one becomes entangled in this material world. Translation. When the she-goat, who had very nice hips for a goat, got out of the well and saw the very handsome he-goat, she desired to accept him as her husband. When she did so, many other she-goats also desired him as their husband because he had a very beautiful body structure and a nice moustache and beard and was expert in discharging semen and in the art of sexual intercourse. Therefore, just as a person haunted by a ghost exhibits madness, the best of the he-goats, attracted by the many she-goats engaged in erotic activities, naturally forgot his real business of self-realisation. When the she-goat who had fallen into the well saw her beloved goat engaged in sexual affairs with another she-goat, she could not tolerate the goat's activities. Aggrieved by her husband's behaviour with another, the she-goat thought that the he-goat was not actually her friend but was hard-hearted and was her friend only for the time being. Therefore, because her husband was lusty, she left him and returned to her former maintainer. And of course, the analogy, she went back to her father. Being very sorry, the he-goat, who was subservient to his wife, followed the she-goat on the road and tried his best to flatter her, but he could not pacify her. The she-goat went to the residence of a brahmana who was the maintainer of another she-goat, and that brahmana angrily cut off the he-goat's dangling testicles. But at the he-goat's request, the brahmana later rejoined them by the power of mystic yoga. So he's telling his wife this story. So, and of course, you know, even Sukhachari is figuratively described as the husband of another she-goat. So he's really taken this example all the way to the top. Prabhupada mentions that about Sukhacharya, that because he used his power of mystic yoga for family affairs and not to realize the Supreme Personality of Godhead, this exercise in the magic of yoga is no better than the affairs of he-goats and she-goats. My dear wife, when the he-goat had his testicles restored, he enjoyed the she-goat he had gotten from the well, but although he continued to enjoy for many, many years, even now, he has not been fully satisfied. Oh, my dear wife, the beautiful with beautiful eyebrows, I am exactly like that he-goat, for I am so poor in intelligence that I am captivated by your beauty and have forgotten the real task of self-realization. So Prabhupada mentions here that unless one is extremely advanced in spiritual consciousness, household life is nothing but a dark well in which one commits suicide. Translation: a person who is lusty cannot satisfy his mind even if he has enough of everything in this world, including rice, barley and other fruit grains, gold, animals and women. Nothing can satisfy him. Yeah, we were discussing, you know, the analogies between Arjuna, that, you know, everyone ends up in a very perplexing situation once we're on the bodily platform trying to enjoy, because this is the world of duality, so there will always just be trouble, no matter how much we try to seek happiness. Arjuna, being on the bodily platform by the arrangement of Krishna, fell into that same platform. He tried to even, discuss religious principles to try and resolve the situation, but that failed because those religious principles he was discussing were also on the bodily platform of life. And Arjuna was in this similar situation, and he said that even if I, gain an unrivaled kingdom on this earth that rivals, the kingdom of heaven, I cannot be happy. You know, such was the perplexing situation. So, again, it's the same theme as the Bhagavad Gita right through. And every single person, that situation in which Arjuna faced, everyone will come to that this material world will perplex one. One is trying to enjoy. And Prabhupada mentions in that purport that it's like the forest fire, the Bhagavad Gita. The forest fire comes, no one asks it to come, and then one is perplexed. Now, I don't know if anyone's heard the news today, but, they've got these massive fires up in New South Wales and Queensland. Anyone seen the news? Massive. Over 100 homes burned down. It'll be one of the biggest in the history of Australia. It's just, huge walls, they're just out of control, and they say that by Tuesday it's just going to get worse and worse and worse, and there's no rain. There's the only thing, there's nothing they can do really. It's so big and so ferocious and so much being whipped around by winds that the firefighters, there's nothing they can really do. They can save a few houses here and there, but it's like the big ones in San Francisco. Prabhupada mentioned, so they're trying to enjoy so much endeavour, and just they end up in this perplexing situation like that. That's the nature of this world. And the only solution, as Arjuna found, is that one has to come off the bodily platform of life, trying to enjoy on the bodily platform, and that includes off the bodily platform of life of religious principles, and surrender to a spiritual master, as Arjuna did, and that will resolve one's problems. As supplying butter to a fire does not diminish, so this is what you were talking about, which is mentioned in the seventh canto as well, right?
There it is. No, too much butter will put out the fire.
As supplying butter to a fire does not diminish the fire, but instead increases it more and more, The endeavor to stop lusty desires by continual enjoyment can never be successful. In fact, one must voluntarily cease from material desires. When a man is non-envious and does not desire ill fortune for anyone, he is equipoised. For such a person, all directions appear happy. Now, in this purport, Prabhupada, quoting Prabhupada Saraswati, that when one becomes Krishna conscious by the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, for him, the entire world appears happy. And he has nothing for which to hanker. On the Brahma Buddha stage, so we're discussing, this is the Bhagavad Gita solution, you know, being summarized also by Prabhupada Saraswati. On the Brahma Buddha stage, or the platform of spiritual realization, there's no lamentation and no material hankering. As long as one lives in the material world, actions and reactions will continue. But when one is unaffected by such material actions and reactions, he is to be considered free from the danger of being victimized by material desires. The symptoms of those who are satiated with lusty desires are described in this verse, as explained by Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. When one is not envious, even of his enemy, does not expect honour from anyone, but instead desires all well-being even for his enemy, he is understood to be a paramamsa who has fully subdued the lusty desires for sense gratification. So, you know, there's a... Krishna explains... In the Bhagavad Gita, so first he says to Arjuna that one must, you know, this happiness and distress which we experience because we've got a material body, one has to learn to tolerate that. Then in the next verse he describes that if one can tolerate that, one can become liberated, achieve a liberation. I was trying to think of the verse. Then later, taking up that same point, Bhagavad Gita chapter 2, verse. When a man gives up all varieties of desire for sense gratification which arise from mental concoction, right, the bodily concept of life, and when his mind thus purified finds satisfaction in the self alone, then he is said to be in pure transcendental consciousness. So basically, if we can practice that tolerance of the happiness and distress, then it allows us to not try to engage in materialistic activities dedicated towards happiness and distress. Such as working towards victory or defeat, success or failure. So by the tolerance It means that we're not going to perform activities, you know, we're just tolerating the happiness and stress, they're coming. We're not going to perform activities that divert us from our spiritual activities. So that means all the things related with, you know, by that little bit of the tolerance, so many things we just don't engage in material activities to, so we don't become involved. If there's no tolerance, then we can't be neutral to happiness and distress, victory and defeat, success or, you know, profit and loss. We can't be neutral to that unless we have that tolerance. So that tolerance allows us to do all those things. And by ceasing our mind and our senses being engaged in those activities related to happiness and distress, then we're able to just put our mind instead on Krishna and spiritual life. And so it all begins with that verse of just tolerance, that little bit of tolerance. If one can't practice a little tolerance of you know, the happiness and distress, which are unavoidable, then one must be affected by all the dualities, and one will engage in activities dedicated to counteracting the stress, bring happiness, and that engages one's mind and senses, which should actually be engaged just in Krishna consciousness. So that one verse is so important, you know. Understand you're a spirit soul, just tolerate like that. So, very, very important verse. It's a beginning of that point of liberation, and without that, liberation won't be possible. And so this verse here, describing that, you know, so by that little bit of being able to practice tolerance, then ultimately that allows that point of no lamentation, no lamenting for something, and no hankering and lamenting. That tolerance allows you to come, you know, that is... Without tolerance, you never come to the position of no hankering and lamenting. That's the point. And our tolerance means, as you know, our tolerance is a positive engagement. That if we just immerse our mind and our senses in the bliss of Krishna consciousness, then we can easily tolerate. So, for instance, someone who's addicted to eating meat, if they eat nice prasadam, then they can tolerate the fact that, oh, I no longer have meat. And that. You know, one who, you know, wants to take intoxication or, you know, this or that. You know, one who, you know, people who are having illicit sex, if they're, you know, they can have regulated sex in Krishna consciousness with their family according to religious principles, then they can tolerate that, you know, there are not so many, you know, girlfriends or boyfriends. So it allows, that engagement in Krishna consciousness allows that tolerance. That tolerance, ability to tolerate, that okay, there's these urges there, but I'm quite satisfied with all my activity in Krishna consciousness, that allows one to come to that point of no limitation, no hankering, and equal to all living beings. You know, being equal to all living beings. That I'm a spirit soul, and because that's a higher stage that's mentioned in the Gita. That you know, a higher stage of spiritual realization is when you know. One may be disturbed by success or failure, victory or defeat, you know, profit or loss, things like that. But what's harder to deal with is how people deal with you. You know, someone becomes your enemy, you know. When we're properly situated on an advanced platform of tolerance and therefore not pursuing material activities, the higher level is where we can do that even with the interactions of the people that we meet in this world. That's a high level. That's much harder than that, to deal with people like that. You know. You know, no envy means that because I don't desire sense gratification, I have nothing to envy you for. You know, as soon as there's a little degree of desire for sense gratification, you know, so for instance, if we want subtle sex life, we want profit, adoration, and someone, you know, disturbs our, you know, good reputation, can we become envious? How dare you? And how dare you get more profit, adoration, distinction? You know, so basically, that freedom from, you know, desire for anything in this world, the very elevated platform of that means that we can deal with people also without envy. That's an elevated platform of that. And it all comes down to being able to just literally engage ourselves fully in what Krishna gives us in devotional service and put our mind into that fully. And then whatever else we don't have apart from Krishna's mercy, we just tolerate. You know, if there's some difficulties on the path, we just tolerate like that. That's. And that little bit of tolerance, if we can't do that, everything is ruined. You know, so for instance, we're talking about here, you know, with this, the sex impulse, which is like an itch. So, you know, a little tolerance, and then, you know, so much rapid advancement in Krishna consciousness, and just that inability to tolerate, then so much, you know, everything else comes from. So it's a very, very important verse, and it comes to this point. For those who are too attached to material enjoyment, sense gratification will be very difficult to give up. Even when one is an invalid because of old age, one cannot give up such desires for sense gratification. Therefore, one who actually desires happiness must give up such unsatisfied desires, which are the cause of all tribulations. And Prabhupada mentions, we have actually seen, because, you know, when Prabhupada was in different countries like France, he would see these old men, you know, 70, 80, going into these nightclubs, you know, he would see them. And, you know, and he knew, you know, their topless places and this, that and the other. So he says, we've actually seen, especially in Western countries, that men who have reached more than 80 years of age still go to nightclubs and pay heavy fees to drink wine and associate with women. Although such men are too old to enjoy anything, their desires have not ceased. Yeah. Prabhupada again quotes this verse by Jamunacharya, you know, that when one is Krishna conscious, he gets more and more happiness by discharging duties in Krishna for Krishna. Such a person spits on sense gratification, especially that of sex enjoyment. An experienced, advanced devotee is no longer interested in sex. The strong desire for sex can be subdued only by advancement in Krishna consciousness. Mm-hmm. And Prabhupada, again and again in his books and his lectures, he says, this is the test of advancement. You know, this is where you really sort out the mouse from the men, or the meat from the women. So, one should not allow oneself to sit on the same seat even with one's own mother, sister or daughter, for the senses are so strong that even though one is advanced in knowledge, he may be attracted by sex. And Prabhupada is saying here, learning the etiquette of how to deal with women does not free one from sexual attraction. And of course, as we're, you know, quoting many, you know, there are etiquettes in heaven, but sometimes the wife of Indra is kidnapped, you know, as Buddha did, and so many different things. It doesn't stop the problem. It's just a psychological fact that, you know, if one's too close to a woman, And even if one is highly advanced, materially or spiritually, he may be attracted by lusty desires. So, therefore, one should be extremely careful in dealings with women. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was most strict in such dealings, especially after he accepted the sannyas order. Indeed, no woman could come near him to offer him respect. So, he says, I have spent a full 1,000 years enjoying sense gratification, yet my desire to enjoy such pleasure increases daily. It's increasing. Therefore, I shall now give up these desires and meditate upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead, free from the dualities of mental concoction and free from false prestige. I shall wander in the forest with the animals. So Prabhupada mentions the best forest is Vrindavan, where one not live with the animals but can associate with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who never leaves Vrindavan. Vrindavan has many temples, and in one or more of these temples one may see the form of the Supreme Lord as Radha Krishna or Krishna Balaram and meditate upon this form. So Krishna and his abode Vrindavan are non-different. Vrindavan is as good as Krishna. Prabhupada, you know, one time he was in the Holy Dome, he was mentioning, you know, Melbourne. He was saying specifically Melbourne. Don't think you're living in Melbourne. You know, if you're Krishna conscious, it's as good as Vrindavan. But, you know, one should not live in Vrindavan and commit offences. For a life of offences in Vrindavan is no better than the lives of monkeys and hogs there. Men who have gone to Vrindavan but who still hanker for sex should immediately leave Vrindavan and stop their grievous offences at the lotus feet of the Lord. One should follow the principles of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and always think of Krishna in full Krishna consciousness. Then one will be eligible to live in Vrindavan and his life will be successful. Translation. One who knows that material happiness, whether good or bad, in this life or in the next, on this planet or in the heavenly planets, is temporary and useless, and that an intelligent person should not try to enjoy or even think of such things, is the know of the self. Such a self-realized person knows quite well that material happiness is the very cause of continued material existence and forgetfulness of one's own constitutional position. Sukadeva Goswami said, after speaking in this way to his wife, Devayani, King Yayati, who was now free from all material desires, called his youngest son Puru and returned Puru's youth in exchange for his own old age. King Yayati gave the southwest to his son Druhu, the south to his son Yadu, the west to his son Tadavasu, and the north to his son Anu. In this way he divided the kingdom. The southeast to Druhu, the south to Yadu, the west to Tuvasu, and the north to Anu. Yayati enthroned his youngest son Puru as the emperor of the entire world and the proprietor of all his riches, and he placed all the other sons who were older than Puru under Puru's control. Having enjoyed sense gratification for many, many years, O King Parikshit, Yadu was accustomed to it, but he gave it up entirely in a moment, just as a bird flies away from the nest as soon as its wings have grown. So the purport that Maharaj Yayati was immediately liberated from the bondage of conditioned life is certainly astonishing. If one surrenders under the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one is immediately liberated from the bondage of conditioned life as promised by the Lord Himself. Aham tvam sarva papibhyo mokshayami asuccha. Lord Vishnu is so powerful that he can deliver anyone at once if he is pleased to do so. And Lord Vishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, can be pleased immediately if we accept his order by surrendering unto him as Maharaj Yayati did. Maharaj Yayati was eager to serve Vasudeva, Krishna, and therefore as soon as he wanted to renounce material life, Lord Vasudeva helped him. We must therefore be very sincere in surrendering ourselves unto the lotus feet of the Lord, then we can immediately be liberated from all the bondage of conditioned life. This is clearly expressed in the next verse. So Prabhupada, you know, would say that, you know, if we're having some difficulty with material desires, he said, if you pray to Krishna, he will help you. Translation. Because King Yayati completely surrendered unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vasudeva, he was freed from all contamination of the modes of material nature. Because of his self-realization, he was able to fix his mind upon the transcendence, Parabrahman, Vasudeva, and thus he ultimately achieved the position of an associate of the Lord. Prabhupada mentions in the purport that as soon as one is freed from all the dirt of material contamination, as Maharaj Yayati was, one's original position as an associate of the Lord is revealed. This is called Swarup Siddhi, or personal perfection. When Devayani heard Maharaj Yayati's story of the he-goat and the she-goat, she understood that this story, which was presented as if a funny joke for entertainment between husband and wife, was intended to awaken her to her constitutional position. Thereafter, Devayani, the daughter of Sukracharya, understood that the materialistic association of her husband, friends and relatives is like the association in a hotel full of tourists. materialistic association of husband, friends and relatives is like the association in a hotel full of tourists. The relationships of society, friendship and love are created by the maya of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, exactly as in a dream. By the grace of Krishna, Devayani gave up her imaginary position in the material world, completely fixing her mind upon Krishna. She achieved liberation from the gross and subtle bodies. Well, if you think of it, in our past life, right, we come together with husband, wife, children. Now we don't even care about it. It's like, you know, it's like our past life was like a hotel we come into, and, you know, the people we're associated with, oh, you know, everything, you know, it's, someone's left it, that's the world to us, someone's arrived, someone's, you know, likes us, someone doesn't like it. It means everything to us. And it's like that when people go to a hotel, you know, they kill each other sometimes, you know, or they fall in love with each other, and then they wake up in the morning when they're sober and they think, you know, what the hell happened? So, you know, our last life is like that. You become intoxicated with all these people. You just become... And now we don't even care. This life is like a next hotel. So it's a good analogy. Yes. O Lord Vasudeva, O Supreme Personality of Godhead, you are the creator of the entire cosmic manifestation. You live as a super soul in everyone's heart, and are smaller than the smallest, yet you are greater than the greatest and are all-pervading. You appear completely silent, having nothing to do, but this is due to your all-pervading nature and your fullness in all opulences, I therefore offer my respectful obeisances unto you. So we'll read this last purport that how Devayani became self-realized by the grace of her great husband, Yayati, is described. Describing such realization is another way of performing the bhakti process. So, we're going to hear the descriptions of her realization, and in that way we execute bhakti. By hearing from her husband about the greatness of Lord Vasudeva, Devayani certainly became convinced and surrendered herself under his lotus, under the lotus feet of the Lord. This is knowledge. Surrender to Vasudeva is a result of hearing about him for many, many births. As soon as one surrenders unto Vasudeva, one is liberated immediately. Because of her association with her great husband, Maharaj Yayati, Devayani became purified, adopted the means of bhakti yoga, and thus became liberated. So, you know, very, very interesting pastime where, you know, her and her husband have engaged in so much sense gratification for over 1,000 years. And, you know, fulfilled that side of their life, gave that side of their life up, although, you know, they're always somewhat God conscious, surrendered to the Lord and attained Sarup City. And you know, so therefore, you know, we can understand that certainly the grihasthas in Krishna consciousness, by, you know, in one life as a grihastha, but at some stage in this life, coming to the point of full surrender, you can go back to Godhead. You know, one shouldn't consider that, oh, you know, the person spent most of their life as a grihastha, they never took sannyas, right? You know, therefore, how can they go back to Godhead? No. They can actually have a good life in Krishna consciousness, in family life. And this is why we shouldn't be disdainful. You know, we want to attract people. Have a good life in Krishna consciousness. But at some stage in his life, fully surrender and go back to God.
Last minute, last break, full surrender.
Don't leave it too late. Yeah, let's not leave it too late. You might miss the bus, but... Yeah, I don't want to miss the bus. They say that people who live closest to the bus station are always late and miss the bus more often than others.
But how do you know which one is the last breath?
That you could say that could be the brahmacharis and the sannyasis. They could miss the bus.
Huh? How could we say which one is the last breath?
Our last breath?
We don't know this.
No, we don't. Yeah. So therefore, you know, we should always be trying to surrender, and at some stage we're going to succeed fully. But if we do surrender fully at any moment, then you can be fully liberated in a moment and be eligible to go back to Godhead in a moment. That's you know, the nice point about that story. So we've got 5 chapters to go, and so we'll continue again next week. So that was where we will hear the dynasty of Puru. So today we did the entire, you know, we did the all about from Anu. And Yayati, his father, and we're going to hear about Anu's brother Puru, which leads us to the Kuru dynasty. And next time we'll also hear about the further about the dynasty of Yadu, another brother, which leads to the Brijni dynasty as well. All right, thank you very much.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Basically, like when earlier you were saying that if you take to devotional service, there's no hassles and you can go back home to God. So then, when we see about Bharat Maharaj, who gave up everything, cleaned up everything, and took to devotional service, and then he fell down. So he just, I'm just saying, thinking about it, we learn from that that. Anyway, if you still fall down, Krishna said to protect you, so don't be worried. That's still the better path.
Yeah, there's no. That's what Krishna says in the Gita. There's no loss.
There's no loss.
No.
You will just be there.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I mean, so we should not be afraid that okay, there could be hindrances in that line. So just take to that. So that is the best part.
Mm. Yeah.
If somebody asks, that's the best. That's the way. That okay. Yes. There may be devotional service itself. You may have to undergo purifications because from Mahatma there was some, I think,
discrepancy.
There was something there in his past, this thing, which because of that he got attracted to them.
Yes.
So because the thing is that even after he went into such a high level, he was in prema level. No, not he was in bhava stage. Even at that stage, that could not, because we say that devotional service wipes off, does all the cleansing process. But even in bhava stage, he was not totally cleansed. He had to go through another lifetime, two more lifetimes before he was liberated. And we talk about Vyasa being liberated in this lifetime itself.
Well, the point is this, that what we learn, you know, from these different pastimes is that we can't, the safe position is fully surrender to Krishna, and even on an advanced stage, if we again contemplate enjoying sense gratification, it can be, you know, that delay in our spiritual success is there. So that's what we were saying, that, you know, it's good for all devotees, whether they're brahmachari, sannyas, grihastha, to look at themselves, you know, with a little shame that, I could have made advancements so much quicker, you know, but I know that I've got impurities in my heart, and, you know, I've allowed that to really slow me down, you know, myself down. So if we allow, so we should, you know, Bharat Maharaj, he could have made advancement back to the spiritual world so much quicker, but he allowed something to slow him down. So he had to take birth, you know, as the deer and then, you know, like that. So the point is that we don't have to go through that. But if we've got impurities in our heart, even at an advanced stage, and we allow it, if we go there, it will cause an obstacle and slow us down from, you know, achieving Shroop City and going back to Godhead. So in this life, so it doesn't matter whether you're on the stage of Bhava Bhakti that applies, or you're in the beginning devotee. It doesn't matter whether you're a Grihastha or a Sannyasi. If there's some little something in the heart or some discrepancy, we should just not act upon it, but just tolerate it, you know, be neutral to it. As Krishna says in the Gita, the 14th chapter of the Gita, even when the modes are present, we should remain neutral and transcendental to it. And a really nice statement, that there's some impurity. Just like, as an example, say someone used to eat meat. They come to Krishna consciousness. They're eating their foods, and say after 4 or 5 years as a devotee, and they're eating the nice prasad, the thought comes back in their mind, oh, I used to, you know, have bacon and eggs, and it just pops back in their head and they think, oh, I'd like some. Now, they remain neutral to it. It's there, but don't act on it. You just keep your mind, just keep going. As soon as they act on it, that's going to create a whole series of obstacles in their devotional life. Okay. It's going to slow them down, you know. So the point is, it doesn't matter whether you're on Bhava Bhakti or you're at the start. The verse that was quoted in the Bhagavad Gita, that if one is fully engaged in devotional service, then they're translated situated. That's what we practice. Even the impurities are there, then we just, you know, something comes into our mind, and then what we do is we say, okay, but I'm not going there. It's come into my... So at different stages of devotional service, on Bhava Bhakti, something coming into your mind like that is very rare and just little taints. The beginning, as a beginning devotee, it's like, you know, trying to get to think of Krishna at all is hard, you know, because there's so much disturbance in your mind. Bhava Bhakti is just always Krishna, and a little tint may pop into their head, you know, at some stage. But still, although it's a trace, if we go there, we're going to have the same problem as a neophyte, and it's going to cause slow our spiritual advancement down by some lifetimes. That's the whole point, is that as soon as we just keep our mind on Krishna and keep engaging, we can go back to God in this lifetime. And as soon as we allow something to take our mind away, it can easily cost us so many lifetimes. That's what we have to be aware of. It will slow us down in this life, and the net result is another birth or several births. And that's what we're, you know... So that's the point of it.
Yeah.
You're not safe until you're really on the platform of Prema Bhakti. You know, Bhava Bhakti by and large is safe, but it's not, you know, guaranteed. You've got to get to Swarup City, you've got to get to Prema Bhakti, and then you can do what you like.
Would we say that, just for the discussion's sake, that Balmaj was more safer in his grahasa life? If he had been there without giving up all that, and I would go to
God. Yeah, that's...
If he has a grahasa doing his religious duty and doing devotion service, he would have been more protected.
No, that wasn't necessarily his fault. That wasn't necessarily the mistake he made. It wasn't a mistake of ashram. It was a mistake of neglecting to...
Neglecting his devotional service when he got attached to the deer.
No.
It
was neglecting to discuss the matter with his spiritual master and take his guidance. His spiritual master may have said to him, you know, just leave that deer and just go on with your spiritual life. And that would have solved the problem.
Is there anybody who was in that situation and have taken guidance and been able to come
off? I'll go through the Bhagavad Gita until I find someone there.
The person like Bhat Maharaj could not do it.
He could if he had just said to the spiritual master, look, I've got this issue with the deer. What do I do?
If he
the spiritual master say, well, just leave it.
I'm just wondering whether anybody can do it.
Yes,
Is it possible?
Yeah, if you keep hearing from Krishna through the devotees, through his Bhagavatam, through the Gita, through the Guru, through the associated, if you keep hearing in a submissive way, you can do it. In other words, what you're saying is, you know, I've got two ears, but, you know, there's a great impediment for me to hear. Now, actually, hearing is very easy. Usually you just sit down and let someone else speak. So, you know, you ask, can anyone do it? Yes, anyone can do it.
No, that's very not easy.
As Prabhupada would say, what's the difficulty? But, you know, as we mentioned, actually, you know, in some temples, not mentioning anyone in particular, but, you know, people find it almost impossible to hear from another devotee, especially a senior devotee. Anyway, we've heard too much, if that's possible.
Shukracharya, wasn't he the spiritual master of the demons?
What's that?
Shukracharya, wasn't he the spiritual master of the demons?
Yes. Yeah. He was still a nice person, though. Yeah, he was a brahmana. You know.
He was more attached to fruitive work.
There was
pure devotional service.
Yeah, that's right. And that's what we're, you know, that's one of the main themes that we're taking from this, that unless, you know, all these great personalities, sages, demigods, unless one is actually fully engaged in devotional service with one's mind surrendered to the Lord and always fixed on Krishna, it is not possible ultimately to properly, fully control the mind and senses. There is some significant degree, like these sadhu yogis in that have, and demigods, but you know, eventually Maya is, you know, just Maya is too powerful. The only thing that can conquer Maya is Krishna. And if we have, you know, take the lotus feet of Krishna, Maya can't come there. You know, so you're either in the sunlight and there's no darkness, or you're not in the sunlight and then immediately there's, you know. So where there's Krishna, there's no dark Maya. And, you know, if you step out of Krishna's association, then immediately Maya's there. And that's as simple as that.
There's no cloudy area.
Cloudy area, a little bit of Maya. stay out of the grey zone.
Little bit of Krishna, little bit of Maya.
Take the full sunshine. It's very therapeutic for our spiritual advancement. All right, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Hare Krishna.
It's cloudy today.
depends which side of the clouds we're on. Doesn't it?